This is KUOW's The Record. Welcome, I'm Bill Radke. At the Democratic National Convention this week, you've heard so much from frustrated Bernie Sanders supporters, many of them from here in Washington State. Not everybody is so down. Jamie Smith is a Clinton delegate from Renton, and she feels the party coming together. Well, my first question, Jamie, is why Hillary?
It took a little while, actually. So I was an Obama delegate to the state convention in 2008. But what really kind of won me over to Hillary and kind of started this whole thing was after the 2008 concession speech at the DNC, she turned all of her delegates over to Obama and then went to work in his administration. And in my mind, that shows a depth of character that I really haven't seen from a whole lot of politicians. So when this year came around, I was kind of caught between Hillary and Bernie. And Bernie was saying a lot of things that I really like to hear. But there were two things that kind of turned me towards Hillary. One was when Bernie was at the Netroots Nation conference in August, he and Martin O'Malley were talking and they were interrupted by Black Lives Matter protesters. And, he actually threatened to walk off the stage. He said, if you don't want me to be here, I won't be here. And I was really shocked at that. About a week later, I think in Keene, New Hampshire, Hillary had the same thing happen to her with Black Lives Matter protesters, and she actually requested a meeting with them, the transcript of which I found online. And so after reading the transcript, you could actually see her listening to their concerns, thinking of ideas and ways to actually make things happen. And so that's what really turned me towards her for this year.
As you know, a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters who are all around you now in Philadelphia have been saying that I've heard sellout, I've heard pragmatic, but what's...
Oh, what is the really? Have you heard Shillery yet? You know,
Shillery. There you go. So yes, I want to know when you're having that conversation with a diehard Bernie Sanders supporter, how does that conversation go in Philadelphia this week?
So it kind of depends. There's two kinds of diehard Bernie supporters that I've met since I've been here. And of course, we're talking about national delegates. So these are the folks that are really hardcore for either candidate. So, the goal is not necessarily conversion. The goal is more kind of like compromise. And can we at least, coexist together? So I'm hearing, the difference is from, the Shilleries and she's a sellout and never Hillary, and those folks are just the folks you just listen to. They're venting, they're explaining their position, there's no convincing going on there. But then there are another type where, they are very much, very much supportive of Bernie, but they're also big, they're also little D Democrats. They are, they are very much into the Democratic Party. They're very much supportive of the Democratic Party and our true blue. And those are the folks that it's actually easy to have a conversation with because we actually have a lot in common. 80 to 90% of the things that Hillary stands for and what Bernie stands for are the same. Essentially, they have some differences as to how to go about it. And I think that's what, we can find that common ground on.
Those Sanders delegates who are not on board with Hillary Clinton, the comedian Sarah Silverman this week famously told them, "You're being ridiculous." How do you feel about the Sanders delegates who are holding out in Washington State? Do you feel they're being ridiculous?
I don't. I disagree with Sarah on that one. To be perfectly honest, in 08, when there were the Hillary Democrats were definitely not trying to hear anything us Obama Democrats were trying to say. It's very easy to just kind of dismiss them and just kind of say, oh, you go sit over there. But honestly, they have a point of view, and they can continue to, to have that space to, to express themselves and to say what they want to say. And that's totally fine. When they're ready to come back into the process and kind of work with people, then great. But until then, I don't feel like we need to chastise them or force them into one way of thinking or another.
What do you say when one of those Sanders delegates tells you, as they have told me, that mm-hmm. you felt it for Bernie Sanders for a period, that hold on to your hope? Are you settling for less with Hillary Clinton?
Let me say this. Hope and change is great. I totally espouse it. I think hope and change was done with Obama. You know, we needed that. We needed that stop the bleeding kind of message when we were going through the recession and we were losing 800,000 jobs a month. At this point, what we need to do is actually get down to the root cause and discover what the cure is. And I think that's what Hillary is really going to be good at getting down to that root cause, getting that problem, then putting concrete solutions in place in order to address the underlying problems. You know, hey, that's great to have hope, but we aren't as bad off as we were when President Obama took office. And I think we need to take stock of that and then improve.
Finally, Jamie, since most everyone already assumes Washington State will vote for Clinton over Trump, what will motivate you to campaign hard for Hillary Clinton between now and November?
Well, I don't view anything as a given, to be perfectly honest. I think it would be really foolish of us in the Hillary campaign and us as Democrats to assume that Washington is a given. You know, there is a significant Republican base in Washington, and you know, we do have some work to do here. Now, granted, it's less work than we would have to do in, say, a hugely red state like, you know, Nebraska, but I don't think it's wise for us to take Washington for granted. Me personally, I will be doing phone banks, I will be raising money, and I will be doing interviews like this to continue to get the word out and to support Hillary in her bid to be the first woman president.
That is Jamie Smith. She's a Clinton delegate from Renton, and she's at the Democratic National Convention this week, and so are we. We talk now to KUOW's David Hyde, live from the convention center. Hey, David.
Hey, how's it going, Bill?
It's good. I understand the Washington delegation got a private meeting with Bernie Sanders today.
Yeah, and as you know, over 70% of the Washingtonians here are Sanders delegates, and Bernie Sanders urged them to keep fighting. He said the political revolution they started is going to keep going past November, and a lot of them have been telling me the same thing. They really believe it, but it was also an emotional moment after he left. There was hugging, there was crying, and for many of these folks who worked so hard for Bernie Sanders, they say there's just a real sense of loss.
And maybe some catharsis. So you were also at the Republican convention last week. I wonder how you compare these two events, David.
Yeah, these are my first conventions, and I've, you know, just watched them forever on TV. And one thing that really stands out for me behind the scenes is just all the drinking. The booze is just flowing at these various events.
That's a different kind of booze than we've been hearing about.
Exactly. Yes. But from what I could tell, the Republican delegation kind of wins on that score. They really, really like to party it up there in Cleveland. And it's worth noting that the Republican breakfast in Cleveland was a lot later in the day. It was at 9:30 a.m., where the Democrats' breakfast here in Philly starts at 7:30. And that's East Coast time, right? So there's a bit of a time change, jet lag going on there. But I figure, you know, Democrats, they still have time to step it up. There's still a chance to win.
Okay, the Republicans have been partying. Does that mean Republican conventions have much better evening entertainment?
I would say if you set aside the evening entertainment part that involves drinking, this convention here in Philadelphia is just a lot cooler than the one in Cleveland.
A lot cooler. Why do you say that?
In Cleveland, they had former Happy Days star Scott Baio, Duck Dynasty star Willie Robertson. Here in Philly, it's Boyz II Men, Alicia Keys, Sarah Silverman, Michelle Obama. Do I need to keep going?
All right. You got me convinced on the cool. So here we are. As you mentioned, David, you had always taken in conventions on TV. We're watching. We're listening on the radio. How is that all playing inside the hall with the Washington delegation?
I mean, people love it. They love the speakers. They love the entertainment. Our delegate was on their feet and dancing in their seats when Boyz II Men came out to kick this thing off. But, you know, that's not the whole story. For some of the hardcore Sanders delegates who are here from Washington State, the spectacle that's being manufactured here for television just reinforces for them how kind of inauthentic and staged managed the whole thing really is. I was just on the floor watching. We may even hear in a minute more of people rehearsing the song "What the World Needs Now is Love," and it's really great stuff, but what you see on TV just doesn't convey what the rank and file delegates are telling me they're feeling.
Well, let's talk about how they're feeling, David, because we're talking with David Hyde at the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia, where now, David, the main floor fights presumably are over. It is Clinton versus Trump. How are Washington delegates feeling about Hillary's chances now?
I think, you know, some of them are super happy. They're just really, really excited about Hillary Clinton. Many of them are still excited about this historic moment. But some still worry that Hillary Clinton is going to have a hard time beating Donald Trump. And the Sanders people blame a flawed system. They point to shenanigans within the DNC and the Democratic establishment. They say it produced a flawed candidate who's not doing that well in the polls. And, you know, we've seen this before with somebody like John Kerry. So behind the stage managed spectacle, there are mixed feelings here. You know, happiness mixed with a kind of political anxiety and a touch of bitterness.
It's great to get that perspective when what you hear is, oh, there's so many boos, or else you hear all the spin going on. But, David, we're really glad that you're there in person, so maybe we can talk again tomorrow.
I can't wait.
David Hyde, KUOW reporter there in Philadelphia at the Democratic National Convention. We're going to bring you live continuing coverage of the convention tonight. That begins at 6 o'clock, and you may have heard that the featured speaker tonight is someone named Barack Obama. Hope you can join us for live coverage beginning at 6 here on KUOW. 94.9 Seattle, news and information. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. The Red Apple Market on 23rd and Jackson in Seattle's central area. It's part of the historic center of the African-American community here. Last year, Paul Allen's real estate company, Vulcan, bought the Red Apple for $20 million, and the company's got ambitious redevelopment plans. But Vulcan also says it is mindful of the history of the central area, which makes this project a test case for an important question. Can a real estate developer and a community truly collaborate when history and money are on the line? KUOW's growth and development reporter Joshua McNichols went to a community meeting last night. He's with us now. Hi, Joshua.
Hey, Bill.
$20 million for Red Apple. What all did Vulcan buy exactly?
Well, they bought a whole city block. They also bought the property across the street, but for now they're focusing their development on just this one city block where the Red Apple is, and there's also a strip mall on the site. But what they're going to put there is something much bigger, something maybe a little bit more dense like you might see in South Lake Union, where there's going to be 40,000 square feet of retail and 570 apartments. So it's going to be dense.
And what was the purpose of this community meeting that you went to last night?
To present one moment in the incremental design of this really big project, to show where we are and to get the design review board to sort of weigh in on some of their initial efforts and look at how they're doing.
Okay. The community's there. Design review board weighs in. And what was the mood?
Well, I heard a surprising amount of optimism. You know, it was a really hot night. We were in the basement of the Central Area Youth Association, and there's all these fans, and everybody's sweating. And yet, Joe Staton, who runs the Central Area Youth Association, he said Vulcan has been reaching out, and that's helped him start to feel okay.
Change is happening. There's nothing you can do about it. We've been here 53 years. Now we're struggling to stay here. You know, this is a big development. But you have to look at it like if it was somebody else doing it, I think it would be a lot different.
So Joe went on to say, you know, he's hopeful about what this development could bring to the community. And you can hear that hope in what a lot of different people said. For example, he said, you know, his organization, they've put their property on the market because they're looking for a partner, somebody to come in and basically bring in some money so that they could stay where they are. And he wasn't asking Vulcan to be that partner, but you could kind of hear in his voice like, you know, maybe they could. So, you know, everybody there seemed to have some dreams that they would put on this future development. Maybe it could help me and my community in some way.
Some dreams. Now, the architect for Vulcan has presented some of their designs for the site. Based on what we've seen so far, would you say Vulcan is apparently listening to this community?
Well, it's still very early in the design process, but we saw some hints of how they're responding to community. For example, you know, people care about the small businesses that are in the central area. You know, many people have moved out, but some of the businesses that serve the African community there still exist. And so one thing that Vulcan has there is sort of a staircase of commercial spaces. Like you've got tiny kiosks. You've got some spaces for tiny kiosks that could operate on the sidewalk. Then you've got some like smaller or a little bit bigger spaces that they could move into as their business grows, and then a little bit of a medium-sized commercial space where they could move up into after that. So there's this idea that maybe they could foster businesses and help them develop in their growth. And that could apply to some of the minority-owned businesses in the central area. Also, you know, they presented some inspirational images of African art that they thought could influence the way the building looks. For example, they put up an African wedding blanket in one of the slides and said, look at some of the geometry here. Maybe we can incorporate this in some way into the texture and the ornamentation of the building.
So are you saying virtually everyone in the community is on board?
No, by no means. Okay. Not exactly. For example, one man was interested in – he was very inspired by the sort of African arts motifs that they were presenting, but he wants it to go further. He wants it to go deeper and not just be, you know, something that's put up on the wall and, hey, there used to be an African-American community here. He wants to see these things integrated in a real and authentic way. But other people said, you know, it's not just the African experience that reflects our reality of this place, but the urban African-American experience. Where is the history of the central area sort of represented in this project? So that was very important to this person.
There's a lot of legacy here for me. And will my children be able to come back to this community at some point and see their relevance and feel invited and feel welcomed and have fond memories of this is where I grew up? That's what's bittersweet about it for me.
And that was Anita Adams. She lives nearby. But she brings up this bigger question of, will we be reflected in this new development? Will my community here that's in the central area now be reflected here? You know, that came up with that question of the art. Is it real, or does it just become part of the marketing of the branding of this building? Little things like, you know, Vulcan is putting in a community space, but that community space will be shared by the tenants of the residences there. So, you know, little things like how much of it will be for the community, or will the tenants kind of take it over at some point and be like, this is our tenant space? There's a public walkway going through the center of the development, but how public will it be? There's going to be some gates that'll close up at night. So there was some question about how public is it, or is it kind of a private courtyard? But also, will this community be literally, not just symbolically reflected or offered a space, but living and shopping in this building? Will there be places for seniors who are on lower incomes, or the businesses that have managed to maintain a foothold there for so many years?
Wow, Joshua, these questions you're getting at, what's real, what's marketing, what's authentic, what's a facade, what's justice when money comes in? It's just, these are fascinating, great questions and hard to pin down. And it's a long process that we're talking about. You are reporting a larger story about Vulcan's development at this corner, 23rd and Jackson. What are the questions you want to get at?
My question is, what particular obligations does a developer like Vulcan have when operating in a community like the central area with a rich history? Can Vulcan, with all its resources, you know, it's not just the real estate company, they also have a foundation. Can it find a way for growth to truly be inclusive? That question becomes more important as gentrification moves south in Seattle. The renovation by the city of 23rd Avenue opened up the central area to redevelopment, kind of like Interstate 5 once opened up farmland for development into the suburbs. It's kind of like this development cannon, and it's pointed towards South Seattle right now.
This is why we have a growth and development reporter on stories and issues and questions like these. Joshua McNichols joining us live. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill.
You'll hear more. This is KUOW's The Record. You live in the Puget Sound area, you deal with water. From up above, from down below, what does water mean to you? That's a question Seattle residents are exploring through the city's Poetry on Buses program. Seattle poet Jordan Keith is leading workshops around the city, asking what it means to be connected to water and connected to each other. And the poetry coming out of these workshops is written in Spanish, Punjabi, Mandarin, and other languages. Jordan Keith told KUOW's Elizabeth Austin why holding the workshops in different languages is important.
So many people are moving from around the world, around the country, to this region, and recognizing that, for me, recognizing that people's stories are grounded in their ancestral homes and their current homes, and the themes of water connect people. So having it in people's different languages allows them to express from their true self, their heart, what they feel, without having to, as one of my friends says, live in translation.
So am I understanding that it's about creating a particularly safe space to explore the issues particular to that community around water?
That's true of all of them. That's true of every single workshop. A particularly safe space where, for example, some people's relationship to water is, you know, thinking of how beautiful it is. I love hearing the stories of what it means in Amharic, that you compare someone who's beautiful, if you want to tell them that you love them, their beauty to water, because water is so precious. Or that in the Chinese community, in the language, that the meaning of water has changed, and that the meaning can mean, do you have prosperity? When I say, do you have water? Do you have prosperity? So being able to speak in English doesn't mean that your culture is translated into English.
Jordan, is there something about poetry that lends itself in particular to dealing with social issues? We've been talking about the relationship to water, the way water connects us. But is there something about poetry for you that allows a conversation about social issues in ways that other forms of writing don't?
Well, I feel that poetry allows us to have conversations about social issues, because when you have that moment in a poem where you're speaking of the universal, there is a little moment where, no matter what your cultural background is, you have that aha. You've lost something. You've found something. You've longed for something. And then in the social context, sometimes means accepting that what you hear someone else saying that they've lost or wish they had is something that you don't understand, and it helps you understand.
I know that you have a poem that relates to ancestral memory of water, one of your own. Would you read it for us?
I'd be glad to. Thank you. The poem is called Diaspora Waters, and it's a renga. And a renga actually is a Japanese form that is traditionally written by multiple poets, all responding to the verse that's been before. And I'm writing it as one author, but responding to the voices of my ancestors and current folk. And diaspora is, of course, how we are all dispersed. The Atlantic within us, the Africa us, carries currents from the west side of the largest continent. Its forehead protrudes into the waters. The mind of Africa erodes, leaves bits of land, granular flesh carrying the shores of Ghana to the casino-lined shores of New Jersey. Frowns arriving in waves leave furrows in the sand. 77% water at birth. We have so little solid ground and flesh to stand on. The continent to continent wind walks on water, looking for her children. Sometimes our memory twirls, winds itself up in despair like a top, like the lady on Market Street wandering in circles because she has lost something. Her feet more concentric with each turn, until like a clock, she raises her hands above her head and starts to scream. Nothing you can do with a restless soul.
That's Jordan Imani Keith reading her poem, Diaspora Waters, a Renga for Africa. So you've offered a number of these workshops now. Is there something you've learned yourself as you teach these?
I have learned that poetry brings adults and children an incredible amount of joy, that people, once they feel like they have permission to write a poem, they are so excited to share the poem right then in that moment and to hold that moment and encourage people that poetry is something that all of us carry within us and we can access. And so I've learned it watching adults because I've become accustomed to adults being afraid to write poetry and having so many people who've never written a poem and certainly not across languages show up and smile and sing their words, if you will, in languages that I don't understand but can recognize the rhythm or the repetition. That's a beautiful thing.
As you've been teaching these workshops in all these different languages, is there something that has come up that has really surprised you in one workshop or another?
I think what surprised me the most was in the Tlingit workshop. A poem that came out of this older woman about red, white, and blue being tattooed in us in a moment captured that red, white, and blue is who all of us are physically, you know, red corpuscles and blue and white cells. I mean, and that tension between being an indigenous person and having the land taken from you and still it's where you are. So red, white, and blue is in you and around you. It was incredible.
So she summed up this whole dilemma in this one image.
In this one image and in about five lines. It was amazing. And it was her first poem.
And that's the kind of thing that a poem can do that no other form of writing does.
It is the kind of thing because it's allowed to not have the lead-up story set, you know, just cut to that particular moment of tension and transformation.
Jordan Keith has been leading the city's Poetry on Buses workshop. She's the founder and director of the Urban Wilderness Project, and she spoke with KUOW's Elizabeth Austin. You can find out more about the workshops by checking out our Twitter feed. We're tweeting out a link right now, at KUOW. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Yesterday, the Democratic Party made history, making Hillary Clinton the first woman nominated for president by a major party.
And if there are any little girls out there who stayed up late to watch, let me just say, I may become the first woman president, but one of you is next.
That is still a remarkable statement in this country. Only 12 American women have run for president. Now, part of that is because women didn't even get the vote until 1919. Margaret O'Meara is University of Washington history professor. She says it's also because of many Americans' idea of the presidency.
Particularly in the 20th century, which has been a hyper-masculine idea. We think about the commander-in-chief. I mean, the iconic first president, the father of our country, George Washington, a general, a military commander, so defined as a leader because of his military leadership, but also defined in very paternal terms. And this is only intensified and accelerated in the modern media era, where presidents or potential presidents have really put their masculinity forward as a reason to be elected and a reason for the electorate to trust them.
Yes, I think of there's the military leader. There's also the LBJ. I'm going to crack heads and, mm-hmm. you know, get things done. So do you think a president, Hillary Clinton, would govern differently from how men have?
Well, that's been the speculation and the assumption. And in 2008, she, as we might remember, ran very, very hard, not as a woman, to disabuse people of that idea that somehow if a woman was in charge, that she would be softer, that she wouldn't be a strong commander-in-chief. And she had to kind of overcome that expectation, that assumption, because the presidency is still so closely associated with these masculine values. And it has to, you know, it's not just the White House. It's leadership in general, leadership qualities. This is something that swirls around the debate about why so few women CEOs, right? Things that are valued in leadership. The leadership qualities are often very male qualities, kind of being forceful, being aggressive, willing to be combative and to, you know, as you mentioned Lyndon Johnson, these kind of these politicians who are very, very good and very, very difficult to, you know, combat in the political arena, that's a real that femininity is equated with weakness.
And we've heard from women that they can't be seen as shrill or they can't be seen as emotional. But maybe women also have maybe they can do things men can't. I don't know. Do you think that a female president in 2016, 2017 mm-hmm. would govern any differently? Or would we say, boy, just there was no difference at all?
Well, one would hope that there would be that you couldn't essentialize like all, you know, male. Of course, we've had 44 male presidents. They've all governed quite differently mm-hmm. and had different styles. There have been these commonalities. I would be surprised if a female president would be able to break out of that role of being the kind of paternal or maternal leader of the country. It was very interesting in Bill Clinton's speech about his wife at the convention, where he is foregrounding her roles as a wife and a mother, as well as her role as a policy leader and tireless worker on behalf of others, but really validating her in a way that because of her maternal qualities, that she cared for people, that she has this softer side. And that's very interesting. It's playing again into these more traditional ideas of women in the political arena, where women have been able to successfully navigate that when they are kind of putting themselves forward as mothers. And as having sort of validity, whether they're Republican mothers of the 1820s or Mama Grizzlies of the Sarah Palin era and everywhere in between. And when women are in the political arena and are not either aren't mothers or being kind of maternal in their focus, then they become open to all sorts of criticism.
Let's talk about the historicness of this nomination. I've been surprised how little Clinton supporters have talked about her gender up until this convention, you know, especially it was like the theme Tuesday night. Do you think that's going to change now that Clinton and the people who want to rally her voters are going to talk more about her gender? Or is that just going to be, are we over that?
I think we'll hear more about it in part of because of who Clinton's opponent is. If she wasn't running against somebody who said such the things he has said about women, had insulting things, misogynistic things consistently over time. It's on the record, and has such low favorability ratings with women. The Clinton camp is clearly seeing there's an opening there for women who would otherwise vote Republican, who are going to vote on the basis of gender, and they're going to vote against Trump because of that. So in this election climate, it's easy for Hillary Clinton to put her gender first. But she's also there's no one like Hillary Clinton. She's operating her role is it isn't like she's just any old woman who's being nominated. She's also someone who for 8 years held perhaps the weirdest job in national politics, that of First Lady. I mean, talk about the complicated gender minefields there. And that is where all of these ideas about wife and mother and the role of women as a supporter of a strong masculine leader really come forth in the role of First Lady, even in the modern era. And these independent career women who have been launched into this job because they married have had to really navigate that very carefully.
So in a way, Clinton's nomination for a major party is historic. But as you're saying, she's also unlike any other woman who would run for president. So overall, how historic does this seem to? I guess it's historic, but how important is it? How much does Hillary Clinton's nomination say to you about today's America?
Well, it's incredibly important and an overdue landmark for the United States to have a female president. It's high time. But
do you feel that personally, too?
I do. I have two daughters. They feel very strongly, too, that the woman should be in the White House. Interestingly enough, I think if on balance, to many people, the election of Barack Obama in 2008 seemed more groundbreaking, more historic. And particularly in this year when we're talking so much about the continuing problem of race and racism in American society, that the color of one's skin seems like more of an impediment to full equality and citizenship than one's gender, even though sexism is still very much alive and well. But it's hard, I think, too, for people, particularly young women, to look at someone like Hillary Clinton, who's been a public figure since they could remember, and has been a figure of power and of the establishment, and someone who she's a very familiar and an old face in a year where people are really hungry for change, even if change comes in the form of someone who's, you know, even older and male like Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump.
We're talking about the historic moment of Hillary Clinton's nomination as the presidential top of the ticket for the Democratic Party with University of Washington professor Margaret O'Meara. Any final words to leave us with, final thoughts about the moment we've come to and maybe the rest of the campaign?
It's been a very long road, as has been said a lot in Philadelphia this week, to a female nominee. I do hope that even though Hillary Clinton is a singular candidate and her place as the leader of the Democratic ticket, it'll help redefine the notion of the presidency. Now, it'll depend on the outcome of the election. But if Hillary Clinton wins in November, then we will have 4 years in which a White House and an Oval Office that has been very much a job that has been very much defined by masculine qualities, paternal qualities, a family man, being a strong commander in chief, will have to accommodate having a woman behind that desk. And I think things will change. And it'll be interesting to see in the coming generations how the office of the presidency morphs and changes even further.
That's University of Washington history professor Margaret O'Meara on the nomination of Hillary Clinton as the Democratic Party's presidential candidate. Imagine all the big issues of this campaign, from the gender and the rhetoric of the candidates to illegal immigration and crime, all showing up in a little desert town, a small desert town where glowing clouds and pyramids suddenly appear in the night sky and a magical floating cat lives in the bathroom at the community radio station. This is the weird world of the podcast Welcome to Night Vale. Jeffrey Craner, the co-creator, recently said that when the so-called transgender bathroom law passed in North Carolina and Washington State took up the same debate, Craner told Ross Reynolds that pushed him to explore gender issues in Night Vale.
It was frustrating to me and to so many people I know, and I wasn't really sure how to tackle it directly because I think a lot of our listeners already feel the same way. And so one thing I did in a recent episode was there's a character named Kaushik who is the station cat that floats 4 feet off the ground in the men's restroom and has always floated 4 feet off the ground and always will float 4 feet off the ground. And Cecil loves Kaushik, Cecil, the host of the show. And in a recent episode, Cecil makes mention that they've changed all their restrooms to unisex now, which is great for Kaushik because now everyone can visit Kaushik and give Kaushik the extra attention. And that was just sort of my way of like touching on that and setting up kind of a world in which Night Vale, as monstrous as it can be with actual five-headed dragons and faceless old women who secretly live in your home, a thing like keeping trans people out of restrooms is not an issue there at all. And I thought that that's a way of playing with the satire without being on the nose.
So you explored gender identity in other ways also in Night Vale. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how.
Sure. We have a character, a relatively new character on the show, who's the new sheriff in Night Vale named Sam. And Sam is gender non-binary. We have
For people who don't understand, what is gender non-binary?
It is a person who does not identify as he or she on what we have as a traditional, you know, one or the other gender spectrum. And we, in describing Sam and when Cecil talks about Sam, Cecil talks about Sam in the singular they. So on the show, we don't really get into Sam's gender identity. We just simply have Sam as a they.
So you script it without a male or female pronoun.
Correct. That's exactly it, on purpose. Mm-hmm. And that's very intentional. In fact, it came up because somebody sent us an email complaining about how we used a singular they in some earlier episode. And just to fight off the grammar assault. I was like, well, I'm going to show you how you use singular they in a very appropriate, very traditional way. And that's what we did. And it was a fun way to sort of battle against that. And I think the gender, singular they has been a really popular point of discussion for a lot of people recently. And it was our way of putting it into the show. And it was also our way of including a gender non-binary character in a, you know, in a major position in town without making that their sole identity. We didn't want Sam to be the gender non-binary character. We want Sam to be the sheriff of the town, is what we want Sam to be. And so by setting it up that way, we don't spend a lot of time doing an after-school special explaining gender non-binary to our listeners. We just simply put a gender non-binary character in a real everyday role in a real town, fictional town, but real to us because we're writing it.
So what led you to want to take on gender in this? Was there a prompt?
Just it's something that is important to me as a human living in the world. And I meet so many people who are men, and I meet many people who are women, and I meet people who were not necessarily assigned that gender on their birth certificate. And I meet a lot of people who do not identify under a gender at all. And I know several of these people in my life, and it just seemed strange not to include them in our show. I mean, Joseph and I talk about when you include people in a story, you want to show the world as you see it. And the world as we see it is not a bunch of people that look and act and seem like me and Joseph, 30, 40-something straight white guys. And that's not the whole world. And that's kind of boring to us as 30, 40-something straight white guys because we just live that life. I want different people. I want to see how the world really looks.
I think you said a little bit earlier it's ostensibly a comedy or a humor program, but it's got some very dark elements in different places. It looks at fear. It looks at anger. And I'm wondering now when there's a lot of fear and anger in the air. I mean, I mentioned the Republican National Convention, mm-hmm. which just ended, which was fueled by fear and anger. Why do you choose to examine those kinds of things? Why not just provide some escapism?
Rather than making just silly jokes or absurd jokes all the time, I think jokes can serve to point to real events or real issues that we want to deal with. You know, humor is a really great way of battling politics. It's a really great way of progressing thought.
And fear, for that matter.
And fear, for that matter. And I think in Knightville, we do like to step back from jokes a little bit from time to time. Pretty often, and just offer something that has a lot of weight to it, just to remind people, listen, you can't always escape into humor. You can't always escape into a punchline. Sometimes it is very real. Sometimes someone dies or somebody leaves you, or sometimes people you don't want to win. And that's just a world you have to face down, and you have to just sort of accept it.
I have to ask you, will Donald Trump be showing up in Night Vale between now and November?
We did when we started the character of Sheriff Sam. We made them in fact, they still are very xenophobic in Night Vale. We've been having this recurring storyline of the local town of Desert Bluffs, whom most people in Night Vale say rival city of Night Vale. And Desert Bluffs is economically on a downturn, and a lot of people from Desert Bluffs have been moving to Night Vale. And the new sheriff, Sam, has made as their point to try to keep them out of town. And so that it really did start as kind of a Donald Trump thing. And I was not interested in exploring Donald Trump as a character in town. I was interested in exploring somebody who cares a lot about their town and who's a real person having real crisis of conscience of how to save a city and going down a certain path. So I've tried to play around with making Sheriff Sam a likable and unlikable character in that way, because they're like a lot of people. They're rich and full of contradictions and full of terrible opinions about the world and also a lot of goodness, and I'm trying to play both.
Jeffrey Craner is the co-creator of the terrific and hugely popular podcast Welcome to Night Vale. We're tweeting out a link to that podcast right now at KUOW. You're listening to The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Did Donald Trump just tell a foreign government to hack a U.S. official? This is Trump today discussing missing emails from Hillary Clinton's private server when she was Secretary of State.
Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press. Let's see if that happens.
The Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan reacted through a spokesperson saying, quote, Russia is a global menace led by a devious thug. Putin should stay out of this election. I suspect we'll hear more on this from the BBC in the next hour. Definitely hear about it on KUOW's All Things Considered coming up today, beginning at 2 o'clock. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. One reason homes are expensive around here is that you're not just competing with local buyers or American buyers. Foreign investors are bidding for real estate, too, all of which drives up prices. In Vancouver, British Columbia, the government is taking action. We welcome our favorite Vancouver Sun columnist, Vaughn Palmer. Hiya, Vaughn.
Hiya, Bill. And, man, if you're thinking of buying property up here as an American, you better get your bid in right away and the deal closed by next Tuesday, because our provincial government is going to whack foreign buyers with a very big tax starting next Tuesday. 15% on the purchase price.
15%, so $450,000 on a $3 million purchase, which in Vancouver is not that unusual.
Yeah, that's sort of a low end. I joke a little bit, but yes, a $3 million house is not unheard of in Vancouver. This is a big, big tax. On the show last week, you weren't here, but we talked about the provincial government having started to keep track of the citizenship of buyers just back in June. They said, well, we're going to start keeping track of it. So they started to keep track of it, and the numbers were so dramatically large that they've decided to step in and put on a tax. In the first 5 weeks of collecting data on this, the provincial government discovered, Bill, $1 billion worth of residential property purchased in British Columbia by foreign buyers, so like $200 million a week, and about three-quarters of those buyers were Chinese citizens.
Right. And what's the goal of the foreign buyer tax?
Well, they're going to put all the money into a special housing initiative fund, which will basically allow the government to support the construction of more affordable housing, of rental housing, building high-rises along the new transit lines, so greater density. Pretty much anything the government wants to do with the money, they can do, as long as it's connected to housing. They've put $75 million into the fund to get started. The government is not saying, Bill, how much money it expects this tax to bring in. It's hard to say. I mean, obviously, if sales continue at the current rate to foreign buyers, it is going to bring in millions and millions of dollars. But some people in the real estate industry say, well, the main effect of this big tax will be to drive people out of the market. Foreign buyers will go somewhere else and buy property somewhere else. Maybe they'll go to Seattle. They're not going to pay 15% atop our already very inflated housing prices.
So there's the effect of making money from foreign investment. There's the possibility of discouraging foreign investment. And is it also supposed to lower prices for Canadians?
They kind of hope it will, not too much. I mean, this is interesting, eh? It's a tightrope for governments. If you really burst a housing bubble, as you know, because of what happened in the United States in 2008, if you really burst a housing bubble, you can create a pretty big economic crisis in your society. People's properties will be underwater. Their homes, their mortgages will be bigger than the value of their house. They will stop spending money. They will get into a panic. They will go into bankruptcy. So the government is trying to walk a tightrope here, Bill. They're kind of hoping if they drive enough foreign buyers out of the market, prices will come down a little bit. What they're really hoping, of course, is you never know with a housing market. If it's a really big bubble, maybe they'll do more damage than they expected.
You made a crack about driving foreign buyers to Seattle. I checked, and Seattle and King County have occasionally asked our Washington State Legislature for the authority to impose different taxes, theoretically maybe including a tax like this, but no, Seattle and King County have no such authority. Is it controversial in British Columbia, for one thing, to make an issue of a buyer's nationality?
Yes, it is. It's controversial. I think one of the reasons the government's held off on this is they're worried about being seen to target people from China, obviously, although they're not Canadian citizens. And if, an immigrant isn't targeted by this, only a citizen of another country. Toronto is watching this. I think cities all over North America will be watching to see the effect of this. It's been tried in Singapore. It's been tried in Hong Kong. So far, in the initial research we've done on this bill, it doesn't look like anybody's gone this far in North America yet, with a 15% tax specifically targeting foreign buyers. But I think you're right. I think other cities, including some on the West Coast, will be watching to see what happens in British Columbia to see, well, first of all, does it turn out to be a cash cow? Second of all, does it do serious damage to investment and to the housing market?
We've been talking about a new tax on foreign buyers in the Vancouver, BC area, talking about it with Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Vaughn, thanks for filling us in.
Bye-bye, Bill. We'll stay in touch on this one.
Excellent. This is The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle, news and information. Yesterday on this show, we heard from journalist Sebastian Younger, the author of a book called Tribe on Homecoming and Belonging. And he said something very interesting, provocative, that some soldiers find themselves missing war because of the camaraderie that soldiers can feel when they're working toward a common good. Now, he wasn't saying we should have more catastrophes, but he did say that disaster situations can bring people together and encourage pro-social behavior.
You don't get mayhem and people turning on each other when things are going badly. You get the opposite. People act a lot better than they do when things are going well. So after 9/11 in New York City, I live in New York, after 9/11, the suicide rate went down in New York. It didn't go up. It went down. The murder rate went down. Violent crime went down. Even Vietnam vets with PTSD said that their symptoms improved after 9/11 because there was this sense, wow, my people need me.
Now, not all KOW listeners were buying Sebastian Younger's theory. Our social media producer, Bon Huberman, is here. Bon, we saw an interesting reaction on our Twitter feed.
Yeah, Barbara's not buying that idea of pro-social behavior at all. She tweeted at us, quote, "What we think we know about disasters is skewed by what story the media tells us. Violence against women is hidden." She makes the argument that women are impacted differently in disasters and claims that there's data to back it up. I think that's a really interesting question. So I lobbed it over to Sebastian Younger on Twitter. Haven't heard back yet, but we'll see what we find out.
Looking forward to that. If you have a question or a quibble or reaction to what you hear on The Record or on KUOW Seattle, let us know. Tweet us at KUOW. Now, in the news today, prosecutors have dropped the remaining charges against Baltimore police officers in the 2015 death of Freddie Gray. While the four trials returned no convictions, the three more scheduled trials are now dropped. Baltimore's state attorney, Marilyn Mosby, says that she stands by the finding that Gray's death was a homicide, and she blamed police for an investigation that failed to hold anyone accountable. Well, the president of the Baltimore Fraternal Order of Police, Gene Ryan, said he is disturbed by those assertions, by the idea that members of the police force were uncooperative and even tried to undermine the investigation into Freddie Gray's death.
The comments made today about our officers by Ms. Mosby were outrageous and uncalled for and simply not true.
Freddie Gray's neck was snapped in the back of a police van and he died a week after his injury. We're going to look into this case further and the latest developments later today on KUOW's All Things Considered. It begins at 2 o'clock and we hope you'll join us.